coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly. Happy New Year and welcome to Worth Doing Badly with me, Jamie Krieger, David Weber and Ethan Stoppenhagen. On this first episode of the new year, we will survey the lessons for the Epiphany of our Lord. And they are Isaiah 60 verses 1 to 6, Psalm 72 verses 1 to 11, Ephesians 3 verses 1 to 12, and Matthew 2 verses 1 to 12. We begin with David Weber.
All right, Ethan, here is the thing which is really puzzling about this text, the Epiphany. The Epiphany is an event, right? It's the event of the revelation of Christ's birth to the Magi, and with that, the whole explosion of Christianity seeing itself as universal. It is not confined to tribes or peoples, that human connections are nothing compared to the connection that God intends to bring about through the gospel. This is what this event did. We know that there is that Christianity is to go to all nations because of the Epiphany. It almost seems like it is uncontroversial, except that we live in a time of polarization and tribalization, and people not being able to see why we should connect with people who are our neighbors or our enemies, but rather to insulate ourselves off into our little warring factions. And of course, the church is really good at being factional and all these kinds of things. So the Epiphany, as an event, to me, is to probably as relevant a text as we're going to get, because it is working against our own obvious sinfulness of wanting to divide and narrow and take control over things. So that would be the one part of the thing of just focusing on the Epiphany. But then when you see how Paul is speaking about Christ's grace and giftedness, that the Epiphany is an ongoing reality, that Paul himself personalizes it, that Christ revealing himself, not just to Magi, but to us, breaking into this world of the light breaking into our life. Paul personalizes that and then explains. So, in approaching this text, I'm going to be reading it in parallel with the epistle lesson. And especially that Paul is saying that the message of the Epiphany is being communicated to and through the church. He calls it, God's wisdom. That the church is at the heart and center of the cosmic change that Christ unleashed in revealing his birth to the Magi.
Are you going to talk about the church in a way that it's in the world, in the sense how it interacts with the world? I know you've talked about Tom Holland's Dominion before, and how in that text he describes how the church has sort of been a light to the world and preserved culture and established institutions. Is that at play with this?
At heart and center, because I hope that Paul enjoyed just how ridiculous his claim that the church was at the core of a cosmic change, that the cosmic change in this universe would happen through the church, and it would happen not because of power or pleasure or politics. It would happen because God gave the gift of wisdom to the church. A message would change everything. I want to find the people who actually believe that, like Paul believed it, because he quite clearly did not understand or could not see what the effect of his preaching would actually be. We can see it. we can actually track it historically, that this ridiculously small thing of preaching going out into the world had, as Tom Holland now has cataloged, has produced the most remarkable and productive civilization on the face of the earth. But because it happens over the course of large periods of time, we know, even from our own education, that people were able to ignore the fact that Christianity was the seedbed of all these things. I'm going to get to that a little bit mm-hmm. later. So all of this comes back to the fact that, first of all, you know, Christ was revealed to the Gentiles, to the Magi. That in itself is such a startling change that made all the difference in the world. And that's why Paul says, look, this is why I'm going to the Gentiles, and this is going to change the world. I'm going to preach them to them. That's ridiculous, except it actually happened. Mm-hmm. Right? So the Eastern Church celebrates this event as the heart and center of Christmas, and that is beginning to make a lot of sense to me. That the point of Christmas is that God is making himself known to people who we would never have anticipated by means we would never have expected.
God is revealed in Christ.
Yes, the revealing is what Epiphany celebrates. It's one thing to have the fact. It's another thing for the fact to take hold. So it would be like someone saying, I'm pro-inhaling, and another person say, I'm pro-exhaling. And now, breathing is both. So being a Christian is both of them. You have to be pro both, the fact that the truth is there and the truth is being revealed. But what I really like is that Paul seems to be so overwhelmed by the idea that this revealing takes place in such small, insignificant ways, that the monstrous effect of this will take place bit by bit, sermon by sermon, you know, from faith to faith, Paul says. All right, now, the event itself, here's what is so almost poetically beautiful about it. It is an event of contrasts, right? It is a lowly town being announced by a celestial star. And all of this is given to make sense of this event, that the two actually work together, that the lowly town is overlooked because it's small, the celestial star is overlooked because it means looking up rather than looking at yourself, and yet these are the two things that all converge on this little town of Bethlehem. And I like the fact that the Magi make the mistake of going to Jerusalem because they think a big cosmic event should take place in the heart and center in a big, impressive way. And they didn't have the benefit of the Magnificat, where Mary made it quite clear that the way this unfolds is it starts at the bottom and it moves up, which means that those at the top are going to have to be moved down. And that's all part of this. This is why this contrast between, first of all, the lowly town and the celestial star, but later on between the outsider Magi and the so-called insider Herod. The Magi make it quite clear. They have been studying the cosmos, and that was their job. And in their studies, they noticed that the heavens had been agitated. They had seen the star. And what do you do when you see something in the natural world that suggests a connection? You study it. And then they said, we inquired about this. And so this whole, the revelation to them was followed by a whole series of inquiries about what this could possibly mean. And they didn't know. They didn't know who they were looking for. They didn't know what they were looking for. The upshot of it, all they knew is that the heavens declare the glory of God, and they happened to be in the right place at the right time in seeing that revelation take place in the natural world.
When we encounter the revelation of Christ, of the revelation of God in Christ, then that should drive us deeper into our study of him, to seek more touch points, more or opportunities to have a little bit more of that truth revealed to us.
You can never say what people, you know, say, well, I've been to a confirmation class. I know everything.
Right.
That's just, that would be like the Magi saying, oh, yeah, we saw the star. Nothing more to do, you know, the job done. You know,
right.
that is what is the essence of boring Christianity. The idea that somehow we've formulated it and now we know and there's no mystery left. And throughout this whole thing, Paul is celebrating. We are living in a mystery. We ourselves are living mysteries. And all of this is made sense of because at the heart and center of things is the fact that, you know, the incarnation and the revelation of the imports. And so, but once again, this contrast, Paul's the lowly and the celestial, Paul says, I am the very least of the saints, right? And because of the smallness, anything that happens is going to have to be attributed to grace. It's going to have to be given to me. You will not find the benefits of revelation. You will not find anything in me that explains what will take place through this gift that has been given to me. And I just love that about Paul. He does not know how his message is going to take hold. All he knows is that he has been given a gift, and this givenness is so saturated, it will continue to set in motion a surprising givenness over and over and over again. So the Magi are given this gift of revelation, and it just starts rebounding and moving forward and producing all sorts of things, which we know as, you know, the universal proclamation of the gospel going into all nations. No one could have imagined that that would be it. And yet we have the benefit of, historical retrospection and now Paul kind of wouldn't have been surprised because he says, whatever this is, it is God's eternal purposes taking hold. That we're not looking to human history or human power or human knowledge. What we're saying here with the epiphany is that this is God's story and his eternal purposes are starting to take hold of the earthly world. And especially, I like the fact that it's given to the Magi, that this mystery, they are the mystery of the Gentiles, Paul says, who are now fellow heirs. And, throughout the gospel, especially in the Old Testament, the beauty of truth is that it joins people together. The Old Testament makes it very clear that it's called justice, and justice is the connection between peoples that is arranged according to God. And you know that there is truth, and justice is that people who were separated come together. And this is the standard thing. This is why the idea of the church as a fellowship, it's not easy. But the whole promise is that this draws people together, and here it drew the Magi to Christ. There's this kind of reconciling and coming together, and they are the mystery, and they have become partakers of the promise of Jesus Christ through the gospel. So Paul is saying this is the movement's underway. Right. This is the gift of the gospel is going to do this. And it is going to move from the bottom up, from the outside in, and it will have this impact, both the event of the epiphany and the ongoing, epiphany where Christ is revealed to the hearts and souls of individuals.
You know, and we so often have the Magi portrayed as kings, and so that was going to be my question, especially in light of the Magnificat, and encountering Herod. You know, what does the Magi's their depiction as kings? How does that factor into this?
They are the ones, the mighty who are humbled, right? Mm. We think of that only as a negative thing. But there are the mighty who recognize that their mightiness is temporal. And for the Magi, they recognize that they are mighty not because they are powerful. They are not mighty because they have expensive gifts. They are mighty because they can recognize that the truth is leading them to that which is greater than themselves. And so we see the Magnificat being played out when they kneel before Christ. Right? But it's not forced, it's free. And that's so much more beautiful that we imagine again in Mary's that this is going to be a grumbling group of powerful that are reduced. And that is true. But there's also those who are reduced and will worship and rejoice in their kneeling before the king. That's my third contrast of the Magi's rejoicing and Herod and all Jerusalem being troubled. You know, we talk about the good news. This is the same good news, right? The good news of Jesus creates rejoicing in the Magi, but it is not received as good news by Herod and those who are troubled by it, right? And so they saw the star and rejoiced, and they saw the child and worshiped him. And now here's what's beautiful. The right relationship is that, yes, they had treasures, but they did not hold on to their treasures. They opened their treasures with gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And the whole thing, the contrast of Herod's grasping for power, trying to gain control over things, versus the Magi who recognize that if Christ is real, then they are free to accept the world as a gift, this givenness, and you know, Matthew declares this whole thing that it's given because it's outside of human control. It happens in the heavens. It happens to people who are outside, you know, the story. It happens, but that in a dream they are warned that God is making quite clear that he's doing something and he is the sole cause of it. And the Magi recognize it and rejoice. It's like liberating. We are not in control. The material world is not in control. This is all controlled by a benevolent, loving and quite frankly, a hilarious creative God who wants to be known and will do all sorts of, you know, wonderful, happy things in order to make himself known. And this event was, Paul says, it was given to bring to light for everyone what is plain of what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God who created all things. This is why Christmas is filled with surprises and gifts. And what I like about the Epiphany is humans are never more than recipients. They're not controlling anything. And when they try to control something, they're buffoons. Herod is ridiculous. And if he wasn't powerful, it would be seen as ridiculous. But now he's just wicked. And Paul talks about this and says, you know, why we think that we're important at all is crazy, because the mystery, Paul says, was made known to me by revelation. He said, it wasn't because I worked hard. It wasn't because I fasted. It wasn't because I prayed really hard. It was by revelation. And this is the mystery of Christ. And then Paul has the audacity to say, this hasn't stopped. This whole revealing of the mystery, it continues. Epiphany is the reality that crashes into our tiny little worlds. And then Paul says of the gospel, I was made a minister according to the gift of God's grace, which was given. Now, you cannot talk about givenness with more, using the same word three times in six words. So, and that givenness is the fact that we celebrate this smallness, this outsideness. We celebrate this. We actually rejoice in it. And he says, you know, you want to see, you know, what the greatness of God's gift? It's in the smallness of the task to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable richness of Christ. We know what happened because Paul did that. Paul had no idea. He was looking at ragtag churches living on the edge of criminality and poverty and speaking gloriously because Paul recognized what the Magi recognized, that this was a remarkable revelation, and that revelation would be at the heart and center of an explosion that would not end because Epiphany goes on and on. Okay, well, then the psalm alerts us to the fact that justice is going to be the effect of this revelation of Christ. Okay. That because Christ has made himself known to the Gentiles, right? That it is God's intent to be known by everybody. That will have an effect on earth. And justice is simply one of the ways that we describe a right relationship, first of all, between God and us, and then second of all, between us and others, right? Now, here's why I hate the word justice, because you and I both know that it doesn't matter on the political right and political left. They will cite a passage from the Bible about justice, but then they'll immediately start talking about politics and elections and powerful and money. Right? They don't really see this justice as central. The justice of God marginalizes the political. It makes it, pushes it to the outside and says, you want to know if justice is right relationship? It has nothing to do with the gaining political power in order to force other people to do what you want. It has something to do with a kind of relationship that is it's spelled out. So, how is justice spelled out? According to the psalm, in countless judgments that are righteous, not their judgments, not because they produce some good or some benefit, only because they are righteous. You counter with that continual justice. And how do you know that these things will be righteous? It's the fact that they cannot be subject to calculation. Justice does not produce wealth. Justice does not produce power. Justice is seen in defense of the poor. Why the poor? Because if the poor are not given justice, they cannot live. The poor are the ones that have to live by this gift. And the psalm makes it quite clear that where those people understand the joy of justice, the focus is going to be on the poor, the small, moving from the bottom up. The psalm says the children of the needy, and not in a political sense, not in a, you know, a social gospel sort of thing. It is within the whole realm of the Christian activity, and this, it says, will crush the oppressor. This is amazing what the psalm says. How does caring for the oppressed crush the oppressor? You care for the oppressed, and that is what crushes the oppressor, not getting enough votes in order that you can somehow call your enemy the oppressor and crush them. Caring for the oppressed crushed the oppressor, and that goes back to Paul. It's because it happens within the church, and the church is purposefully deprived of power, and if we're lucky, deprived of wealth. If the church is actually the gathering of those who are poor and who see themselves as poor, those of us, I mean, hopefully when we're in the church, we recognize that if we do not have the gift, God's gifts, we are lost. It may look like we are gifted, like we are materially gifted or intellectually gifted. If all of that means nothing, if in fact we are not in right relationship with God, and that makes this whole idea of Christ's death and resurrection putting us in right relationship. That is not the ceiling. This is what bothers me so much about people who treat being in right relationship with God as the most you can say. That's the beginning. That's the beginning of a life of epiphany, of the implications of this. And Paul is anything but bored by the fact that he has given this gift of a right relationship. And what Paul says is, no, now you live it out in the church. This is where you find ways to break down the bonds. And it's hard work. I'm Now, obviously, church is filled with sinners, and sinners don't get along well with each other, and yet there is this promise that God's gift is making this happen. So, and again, it amazes me the number of people who think that if you know something about the gospel, you don't need church. Whereas Paul is saying, no, if you know the gospel, then this whole prospect of church is not a liability. It's not a dismal thing. It is actually where we are coming together as the poor and the oppressed. And here's what, as you had mentioned from Dominion, what Dominion actually charts out over the course of centuries is what happens when people are joined together by this bond of justice or this bond of love. What happens when individuals are actually joined? You can't calculate that. It's not like counting money or counting armies. It is a bond that will prove over and over again to be much stronger than anything, any bond that power or money or pleasure can produce.
It becomes a beautiful thing, you know, just here in the last minute. I think that's what the Isaiah passage captures, just to touch on it briefly, is that the church is a beautiful thing, right? I mean, and that's what this passage is talking about. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. And that's, you know, I would say being addressed to the addressed to Jesus, but at the same time, this gathering of lift up your eyes and see, they all gather together, they come to you. I mean, it's just this beautiful scene that comes together, and that is the gathering of the church.
But it comes together, and going back to Paul, it comes together because this epiphany is light. Epiphanos. It's that darker the world gets, the more attractive the light is. And this is why I think it's a big difference between people who want to drive others by power versus this image of drawing, being drawn by the light. And as you say, that light has a beauty to it, especially if you see yourself surrounded by darkness. And then suddenly there is this little tiny light. It doesn't matter how big it is. And it begins to dawn. And the promise is that it's a light that is small but grows larger. It's not a light that just stops. It's not a light that's boring. And the thing about, here's what kills me, Ethan, and I know that we're in the last thing. We are told that the scripture is the light, and what we do is that we stare at the light. Well, if you stare at a flashlight, it doesn't really help you see, it blinds you. What Paul is excited about, he says, you know, here's what happens when I turn this light on the world. It does not look as scary as it used to. The powerful don't look as powerful. That this light is not only a light that draws me, but once I have this light in my heart and in my hand, it makes the world and myself and everything else look different. And that, when you see it in the light of that light, leads to what led the Magi into a generosity and into a rejoicing in this world. It disbands all of the ridiculousness of the Herods, and it celebrates again as a second Christmas that when Christ was given to the world, the gift that keeps on giving was unleashed.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app, download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.